And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, Sam Keen joins us. We're going to talk about the violinist's thumb. It's an amazing story about our genetic code and what it is, who it is, and does it make us what we may be. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you about Sam Keen, a writer in Washington, D.C., author of the New York Times bestselling The Disappearing Spoon, which was also a runner-up for the Royal Society's Book of the Year back in 2011. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Mental Floss, Slate, New Scientist as well. We're going to talk about his latest work, The Violinist's Thumb. And here he is, Sam Keen, on First Coast to Coast. Sam, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good to have you with us. You wrote the book, The Disappearing Spoon. So you're into science a lot, aren't you?
Oh, definitely. That is what I studied in school, and it's really something I'm very passionate about. I don't have the temperament to be a scientist myself, but I really, really enjoy learning about science, writing about it.
Well, and you write about it in a way that people understand it, Sam, and that's so important nowadays. The interesting title, The Violinist's Thumb, tell me about that. How'd you get that?
Sure. The Violinist's Thumb refers to one of the stories in the book. It's a book that really emphasizes stories from different eras, different times of human history. And this is a story about the violinist Niccolo Paganini. He's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived. He was working in Europe in the early 1800s, playing for kings and emperors and popes. They struck coins with his likeness. And there were always rumors that he sold his soul to Satan for his talents, the caliber of musician that he was to earn a reputation like that. And part of the reason he was such a good violinist was he had these sort of freakishly flexible fingers. He could twist his fingers into all sorts of knots, and he could spread his hands incredibly wide. He could just do things with his hands that other violinists couldn't. And it's almost certain that Paganini had a genetic disorder, and that we can trace his very flexible hands to that genetic disorder. And I like this story, and I made it the title story for a couple of different reasons. One, it shows that Paganini, his talent overall is really attributable to both his genes and his environment, because he was also a very hard worker, and he had a strong, strong passion for music. And so it was kind of a perfect storm of circumstances coming together, that this temperament combined in someone with the genetic endowment to take advantage of it. And we're really lucky that all of these attributes came together in one person. So again, it's how your environment and your genes work together to make you who you are. And the other reason I like the story is that while Paganini's genes kind of made him on the one hand, his genetic disorder also caused a lot of other health problems, because it wasn't just his hands that it affected. It affected mm-hmm. all of his other joints and affected other parts of his body as well, this same underlying genetic syndrome. And it, again, it caused a lot of health problems for him. And he actually died quite young and was unable to appear in public for many of the last years of his life. So while his genes kind of made him on the one hand, they helped unmake him on the other hand.
Interesting take. Now, when you were doing your research for this, it's pretty extensive, just with the size of your book here, The Violinist's Thumb. Is it easy for you to access the information to write a book like this, Sam?
Well, it's never easy doing research, but after a while you do sort of enjoy it. It becomes kind of fun on its own to just find new stories or to find out facts that you never knew. You do kind of have to enjoy the research and enjoy learning about things for its own sake. And some of these stories, I'd heard from teachers over the years, or I had just picked up on, so I knew a little bit about them at least. but some of the stories were things I'd never heard about before and just came up in the course of research and ended up being, it was sort of serendipitous that I came across them when I did and could use them in the book like this.
And was there anything surprising for you in doing the work in the research?
There were some surprises, both things about genetics and DNA that I didn't expect that popped up, and also, again, just some stories that I didn't expect. One of the stories that popped up that ended up being kind of one of my favorites and that I'd never heard of, kind of surprised I'd never heard of it, was about some experiments that a Soviet biologist did in the 1920s where basically he tried to breed human beings with chimpanzees and orangutans just to see what would happen. He was very interested in human evolution and thought that this would be a good experiment to do. And the Soviet government actually backed this experiment. And in sort of a peripheral way, but Joseph Stalin was involved in getting some of the funding for this experiment. And I was just kind of surprised that something that sounds so shocking to us today had kind of been forgotten about a little bit in history, and you don't really hear about it. I'd certainly never heard anything about it. But it ended up being a really good way to get at some questions about our genes, which is, you know, what really separates us from chimpanzees? How have we evolved differently from them? So it proved a good way to kind of work in these questions about our genetics. And that's really what the book was trying to do overall, is work these big questions into stories and things like that about our past.
You talk about that a single DNA in a single cell, it mm-hmm. stretches 6 feet long. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so again, DNA in one cell can stretch 6 feet long. And when you look at how that DNA fits inside your cell, it's usually fitting inside a nucleus, the part of the cell that houses DNA, that's only a thousandth of an inch wide. And to think that something 6 feet long could scrunch up so much to get into a thousandth of an inch, it's really an incredible feat of engineering that DNA can do this.
How long, then, would all the DNA in your body be?
If you took all the DNA in your body and stretched it end to end, it would reach roughly from the sun to Pluto and back. That is how much.
In one body?
In one body, yes.
Wow.
Yep. And in fact, if you took all of the DNA on all of the life forms on Earth and strung that all together, it would actually reach across the universe many, many times. It's really incredible that molecule, it's that long and wound up inside your body.
Sam, explain DNA, because it's going to come up a lot tonight as we talk about who we are and what we are. But give us your take on that.
Sure. The basic idea is that DNA is a chemical inside you that stores information about how to build certain things, usually build proteins, which are really the thing that make you go. And again, DNA is a blueprint, and it gets passed from a parent to a child. And that's really how we pass information on to future generations, is through this molecule, DNA. Another related concept that usually comes up with DNA is the idea of a gene. And DNA is really kind of the physical part of this. It's a chemical. You can get it stuck to your fingers. Whereas genes, in a way, genes are a little more abstract. They are, it's like a unit of inheritance. And you can talk about genes without having any idea that DNA exists. And in fact, scientists did talk about genes for a long time without really knowing that DNA had anything to do with it. And I think the best way to think about it is that genes are like the story of humankind, and DNA is like the language that story's written in. So they're definitely related and tied together, but there's something distinct about each one of those things.
How did scientists truly find DNA? Did they have to have huge microscopes? What happened there?
Well, when they tried to find DNA, the first scientist to do this was a man named Friedrich Miescher, who was working in Switzerland in the 1860s, late 1860s. And he basically had the job, he had to catalog all of the different substances he could find in white blood cells. And the best source of white blood cells for him was actually a local hospital where there were a lot of, supposedly a lot of veterans from wars that had a lot of wounds that were frankly just leaking a lot of pus. So he had bandages delivered every day from the hospital, and he would wash the pus out of them, get the white blood cells, and he would look at the nucleus inside the cells. And we now know that the nucleus is the structure that houses DNA. But back then, no one knew what the nucleus did. It just sort of sat there, and no one could see it because it's actually too small, really, to see on the microscopes that they had what it was actually doing. So Miescher began to run a series of chemical tests on this. He basically dissolved everything else away and was left with sort of this, this sticky, cottony, gray paste. And he didn't know what it was, ran some tests on it to see if it was a protein, tried to dissolve it in acids or run some tests on it that should have turned it a different color if it was a protein, and nothing worked. Nothing really affected this cottony paste that he had, and he didn't really know what to make of it. And he eventually decided, well, it must be a new substance. And he called it nuclein, but it ended up being what we call DNA today. And unfortunately for him, scientists accepted that he'd found this substance, but they really didn't think it was very important for a long time. And he ended up dying kind of obscure and unknown and without ever really getting a lot of credit for making a fundamental discovery. Even today, he's not nearly as well known as, say, Gregor Mendel, the man responsible for discovering the gene. So,
the genes, that's right. Would this individual have gotten a Nobel Prize had he been living in this era?
He might have. It's a little tricky because, again, scientists just didn't know what was going on then. He also, unfortunately, died a little young, and you're not eligible for the Nobel if you're that young. Had he been around today, though, and alive and everything, we would definitely recognize this as a truly fundamental discovery, and, yeah, definitely something worth a Nobel.
The DNA... is it so different in every individual, yet are there similarities as well?
Yeah, each human being, we have well north of 99% of our DNA in common with each other. So it's actually very hard in one sense to tell one human being from another because all of the DNA that especially the DNA that's important, that's made, that's kind of running you, is very, very similar. There's still plenty of differences because even if you're talking about a small percent, we still have 3 billion what are known as letters or bases of DNA. So a small percent can still translate to many millions of differences. But just percentage-wise, all human beings are basically the same from a global perspective.
Now, what is RNA, Sam?
RNA is a related chemical, very similar. It's just a little structurally different. RNA is single-stranded, whereas DNA is double-stranded, the famous double helix. And RNA is really the molecule that makes things happen inside cells. We have DNA to act as the blueprint, but when it comes to doing things, making things happen, RNA is really the star of the show. And it took us a little bit of time after Watson and Crick discovered the double helix to figure out RNA was so important. But eventually they came to realize that, oh, yeah, this is the molecule making things happen. And for a while, in fact, Watson and Crick were part of this club called the RNA Tie Club, whose whole goal was to figure out what RNA was doing. And the members would kind of meet informally and exchange papers. But they all had this special green tie that they wore with an RNA strand in gold silk on it. And that's how they distinguished themselves. So there's a picture in the book, actually, of Watson and Crick wearing their ties. It's kind of a funny picture.
Sam, at a crime scene, they're looking for, of course, DNA.
Mm-hmm.
How are they able to pinpoint the difference in order to, finger some individual?
What they're doing, as far as I understand, is they're looking for certain markers that can distinguish you from another person. We all get, for instance, I call them DNA stutters. They're basically these repetitive sections of bases. And each person, you inherit them directly from your parents. And each person, one person might have 14 repeats. Another person might have 11. Another person might have 3 or something like that. And if you look at a lot of different spots inside you, you're going to get a lot of different numbers, a 3, an 11, a 12, a 13, something like that. And the odds of two people having the exact same number of stutters in every single spot is pretty small. It's pretty remote. So if you look at enough different spots in the genome where these stutters pop up, you can rule out a lot of people pretty quickly. And that's how they can identify one person and say, there's a 1 in a billion chance that it was someone else or something like that.
We are made up of so many, I would guess, billions of cells, are we not?
Yeah, it trillions, actually.
Okay. What keeps them all together so, we just don't literally fall apart, physically fall apart? Why does it seem to be stuck together?
Well, cells like to adhere to each other. That is how our cells have grown. Sometimes they, there might be a chemical that kind of makes them sticky. And sometimes their membranes just kind of interlock or kind of glom onto each other. It's just, it all has to do with the their membranes, their envelopes around them, basically, and the fact that they want to, they're designed to stick together. Otherwise, it would be just like a sack of fluid just kind of falling on the ground and spreading
out.
That's
right. It's amazing. Whoever thought of that, Sam? There's got to be a designer somewhere.
Yep. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's got to be one of your next works. There's got to be a designer somewhere. I don't know. What do you think? Maybe?
About there being a designer?
Yeah.
I am definitely of the camp that evolution is a very brilliant designer. It's a way to bring design in with out an actual designer. So that's my, I'm in that camp.
Now, with the genetics of DNA, does it contribute to personality? Does it contribute to ability? Does it do things like that?
Yeah, I definitely think so. You have to be a little careful with that. But scientists are starting to find out that there are genetic influences for, pretty much any sort of behavioral trait that you can think of. A lot of personality traits, things that we wouldn't have expected to find a genetic contribution to. It turns out there is a genetic contribution for a lot of these behavioral and psychological traits. At the same time, we are finding out that genetic influence is just an influence. It's not something that rigidly determines your personality or sort of dictates who you are. And that is a little bit reassuring in some way.
Hold on, Sam. We're going to hit this break, and we're going to come right back and talk about your work, The Violinist's Thumb, on Coast to Coast AM. Talking about genetics, DNA, we're going to take your phone calls next hour with Sam Keen as we talk about his work, The Violinist's Thumb, and I'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Sam Keen with us. Sam, in your book, you present some very interesting tidbits and facts One, of course, let me ask you, John F. Kennedy's bronze skin, wasn't it tanned?
Yeah, that is. I really like the stories about kind of retro-diagnosing your favorite historical celebrities.
Yeah.
And that was one of them, is about JFK and the fact that he had a disease known as Addison's disease. And it actually caused a lot of health problems for him over the years. And one of the side effects of Addison's disease is that you get a nice bronze glow to your skin. So part of the famous Kennedy tan wasn't just him being out in the sun and, you know, being hale and healthy. It was partly from this disorder that he had, this disease, Addison's disease, that can change your skin color.
So though many people thought he looked healthy, deep down inside, he was not, was he?
No, he was not healthy. He had Addison's disease. He also had a lot of other problems, severe back pain, things like that. He actually ended up getting last rites multiple times before he became president because he was that close to dying. In grade school, for instance, they thought he had leukemia at one point. That's how sickly he was. So the fact that he made it to become president is kind of a miracle in and of itself.
Tell me a little bit about the thought that the human race almost went extinct. What happened?
Sure. This was about our time in Africa, you know, 70, 80,000 years or so ago. And if you look at human DNA today and look at just the diversity in our genes across the globe, there's a lot less genetic diversity than you'd expect for a species that has as many individuals as we do, about 7 billion people now.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot less diversity. And from that, you can infer that in our not-so-recent past, we actually had a lot fewer people around. And some scientists go as low as maybe there were only a few thousand adults on the entire Earth. You know, that's below what a good minor league baseball team might draw for a home game. And it's just sort of scary to think about the fact that there were that few people on Earth, and not just in one tribe or settlement either. They were probably scattered into small bands throughout various parts of Eastern Africa. And so, yeah, it's almost like we were the pandas or the condors of that day, kind of the endangered species. And if things had not gone our way, you know, it wouldn't have been that hard for human beings to go extinct at that point.
How do you explain genetic mutations and deformities if DNA is supposed to be intact and truly is really our blueprint for who we are? How do these mishaps happen?
Yeah, DNA is really, really good at making high-fidelity copies of itself, meaning it's very good about copying things exactly over and over. It's just that we have so much DNA. Human beings have 3 billion letters of DNA inside them in each cell, that when you're talking about numbers on that scale, it's inevitable that a copying mistake will pop up here and there. And by copying mistake, what I mean is that DNA uses these 4 chemicals, and they're abbreviated A, C, G, and T. And those are kind of the letters in the DNA alphabet that record information, in that blueprint. And it's just inevitable that at some point, you know, something's going to happen. And they are going to substitute something incorrectly in there. It could be something as simple as a cosmic ray from the sky coming down and, you know, causing, you know, knocking an enzyme aside or cutting your DNA at some point, something like that. And just through these various processes, mistakes get introduced. And when they do get introduced, we call that a mutation. And sometimes mutations don't do any harm. If they're in a part of our genome that doesn't do or make anything, then they just kind of sit there and no one really notices. It's when they get inside of our genes, the parts that are supposed to do things for us, right, that they can cause problems.
If they know this, can they solve potential problems in the future? I mean, you underwent, for example, your own genome test, right?
Yeah, I had my genome tested by sort of a pop testing service.
If you know what's exactly wrong, can you be able to fix it?
It's a trickier question than it might seem at first, because A, it is hard to know what's exactly wrong sometimes, and B, one thing we're finding out is that a lot of diseases that we think about as singular, something like diabetes or heart disease, a lot of cancers too, they look kind of the same from the outside if you're just looking at the symptoms somebody has. But when you drill down to their DNA, they're actually being caused by a lot of different problems. A good example is the fact that genes work together a lot of the time. So if you're talking about, lowering your blood cholesterol, it might take 5 or 6 genes to get that process done. If any one of those genes get mutated, then you might have a problem with the overall process. The problem treating that, though, even though you might have the knowledge now of what's wrong, is that each of those different mutations is going to require a different solution. And that's where it gets really tricky in translating from the knowledge into sort of the medical treatment. And that's really the gap we're facing right now, is that we're getting a lot of good information about the underlying causes of the diseases, but we don't have a good way yet to translate that into medical treatment. So it's definitely a hope that we will be able to use this knowledge more fruitfully. But right now, it's turning out to be kind of a harder problem than we imagined.
Genetically, if somebody's more intelligent than someone else, is it something in the brain that they've got? I mean, do they have a bigger brain, for example? Secretariat, the racehorse had a bigger heart than most horses. Is it the same with, like being super smart?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of genetic contributions to intelligence. It's a controversial area. Scientists are still working out what those things might be, but there are definitely genetic factors that contribute to intelligence. And it could be brain size. It could be also brain connectivity, making different areas of your brain work together better and speak better to each other. So there's different factors that come into play, and we're still kind of sorting these out. But there are definitely genetic contributions. One thing that we do have a little better idea of is what separates the human brain from, say, an animal, like a chimpanzee brain. So we are starting to get some good insight as well into kind of what makes general human genius, kind of widespread intelligence among human beings generally.
That's fascinating work. When you look at all of this, you've talked about how some children are born with tails, why some people don't have fingerprints, which I never knew by the way. Is that the same thing? Is there something going on with the DNA?
Yeah, both of those, it's different things in each case, but when you're talking about, there are people born who have no fingerprints, and it is pretty rare, but it's kind of incredible to think about, we're always told that everyone has their own, unique fingerprint system, except these people don't. They have a problem with what's known as splicing DNA. The basic idea is that some cells might take the same stretch of DNA letters and they might kind of chop it up a little differently. You can think about rearranging the words in a sentence to emphasize something or for different effect. That's basically what a cell is doing with the DNA. The people who have this problem with their fingerprints, it's known as a immigration delay disease. That's what scientists call it, because these people get a lot of guff at border crossings because The people who work at border crossings usually don't believe them, that they don't have fingerprints, and that's why they're not registering on, you know, the test, like the database or something like that. But it's caused with a splicing problem in their DNA. The people without, the people with tails, that's a little different because it's sort of a throwback to our genetic past. We evolved from primates, things that had tails, and all human beings actually have tails until about, I think it's about the 16th week in the womb. We have a very clear, very well-defined tail. In most people, that tail goes away. But if there is some sort of mutation or if something doesn't get doesn't happen inside you, you can be born with a tail. And they're usually pretty harmless. They're usually normal, the babies beyond this, but they do have a tail.
How big are they, Sam? And where are they, at the base of the spine?
Yeah, they're exactly where you'd expect if a human being had a tail, right at the base of the spine, right above your butt. There's actually a picture of one in the book, this little baby. It looks kind of cute in one way, that it has this little tail.
If you're into tails.
If you're into if you like that thing, yeah. And on babies, they're usually, 6-7 inches long at the most, usually smaller than that. They usually get removed right away. They don't really cause many problems, but occasionally, especially in parts of the world where they don't have as good a medical care, they just leave them on. And there are adults out there today who have tails on them, and they're some of them actually kind of like it. They're kind of proud. It sets them apart. So
that is strange. You have talked about how human beings are more virus than human. What do you mean by that?
If you look at our DNA, the part of our genome that actually makes genes, that makes the thing that makes us go, that's only about 2% of all the DNA we have. It's a very small percentage. If you look at the rest of our genome, a lot of it's mysterious. We don't really know what it does, where it comes from. But 8% of that extra DNA actually is old, broken down virus DNA that got inserted inside us long ago and that we just never, ever cleared out. So by that measure, 8% versus 2%, we're four times more virus than we are human. It's one of those facts that kind of staggers me every time it comes up and every time I think about it, but that's the way it happened.
What's a Philadelphia swap, Sam?
Philadelphia swap, or a scientist would say probably a Philadelphia translocation, but Philadelphia swap's an easier way to think about it. It's what happens when we have chromosomes inside us that get tangled up. A chromosome is just a string of DNA, a long string of DNA. That's basically all it is. Human beings, each one of us has 46 chromosomes inside us. And every once in a while, two of the chromosomes get tangled up. They kind of get twisted around each other, and a piece of one breaks off, and it ends up attaching itself to another chromosome. And sometimes, actually, they end up trading tips. They end up swapping tips. One gets one tip, and the other one gets the other one. And when this happens with two specific chromosomes, with 9 and 22, you get what's called a Philadelphia translocation or a Philadelphia swap. It's named after the city in which they discovered this kind of swap. And what it does is it causes a very specific type of leukemia, a blood cancer. And it's a very well-known cause of this type of cancer. And what happens to you is cancer is really a DNA disease. It's caused by mutations inside you that allow cells to proliferate and grow out of control. And when chromosomes 9 and 22 end up exchanging tips like this, it allows the cell to start growing out of control, and you end up with this awful blood cancer.
Interesting take on all of that.
Yeah. And I end up using that in the book because it's the basis of sort of this really horrifying story about a woman who ended up passing cancer down to the fetus that was inside her. And it is a very scary thing to think about, that a mother could end up inadvertently giving cancer to her unborn child. But if the circumstances are right, and if your genes work against you, that can happen. And the Philadelphia swap was one of the two things that was really behind this woman passing down the cancer.
Well, and paleogenetics, what is that?
That's really one of the fields that I get excited about. The basic idea is that you find really old bones or something like that, and you can actually extract DNA from them, bones that are tens of thousands of years old that have been sitting in a cave somewhere. We can actually go in and
Jurassic
read
Park,
the DNA.
Huh?
Kind of. We're not quite at the point where we're resurrecting Neanderthals just yet. But we can actually at least read their DNA sequence. And it's just sort of staggering to me that biology's come this far, that we can read old bones that have been sitting around for tens of thousands of years.
Do you think there was a major difference between, the Homo sapiens and Neanderthals?
We're finding out there's much less of a difference than we thought there was. And we're actually finding out what's even more incredible is that all human beings of either Asian or European descent actually have, a couple percents worth of Neanderthal DNA inside them. That's roughly the equivalent amount of DNA you got from each great-great-great-grandparent. So if you go back five generations in your family tree, you might as well have a Neanderthal there. That's how much DNA a lot of people on Earth today got from Neanderthals. So that kind of throws open the question of, were they actually a different species? If we could interbreed with them and have viable children with them, you could kind of go either way on the question. They probably were different, but not as different as we once thought. They looked different, but it might have been more of a superficial difference than something really important.
How difficult was it, Sam, to sequence the Human Genome Project?
The first time they were going through it, it really was a lot of work, very, very difficult. And it took scientists quite a long time to get this going. And I do spend actually a chapter in the book talking about the entire Human Genome Project and what they were doing, and then the very famous incident where Craig Venter came in and kind of tried to steal the glory of the Human Genome Project with a private sector challenge to the government work, and some of the it wasn't very dignified, a lot of the things that resulted from this, but I think maybe science ended up benefiting overall from it in certain ways. So it was a very difficult job at first, but we're starting to see a lot of the benefits of that and all the incredible things we're doing with DNA work today.
Well, it's remarkable indeed. Where do we get your book, The Violinist's Thumb, Sam?
Should be available at your local bookstore, or you can find it online at various places, too.
All right. And your website, for those who want to peruse what you do?
Sure. It's samkean.com, so just samkean.com, and they can read a short excerpt of the book there, there's lots of other stuff to look at, too.
All right, let's wrap up one more hour, Sam. We'll take phone calls with you. Here's an opportunity to chat with Sam Keen. I'll also get into The Disappearing Spoon. We haven't really talked about it, which was one of his best-selling books. We'll be back in a moment.